Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey guys, welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And today I want to share with you an interview that I gave for Nate over at the Wise Disciple channel. He is a Christian debate teacher. He's a debate coach, debate teacher. And so he has a channel where he just reviews debates between Christians and atheists, and even debates between Christians and other Christians. And I watched his review of my old debate with James White on whether salvation can be lost. And I really appreciated his tone. I've seen a lot of his other videos. He's someone, and you'll see from this video, I think we got along really well. So we had a great chat talking about the purpose of debates, what they're for, how Christians can be better at them. Overall, it was a really great, insightful conversation. I think you'll benefit a lot from this. Be sure to go check out his channel, Wise Disciple. And of course, if you haven't, like this video, subscribe to us here on YouTube, iTunes, Google Play, all of that good stuff. Without further ado, here is my chat with a debate teacher on how Christians should debate.
I want to get into your background, actually. This is why we're having you come on. I want to chat about debate with you. I know my audience has been talking about this a lot more, like, you know, how to debate tactics, debate strategy, stuff like that. So if we can, let's go all the way back to young Trent Horn. Tell us a little bit about your background. Did you do any debate in school, or was that like later on?
Yeah, here's what's funny. I've never taken formal debate classes or debate training. I'm familiar with Lincoln Douglas debate and what are called like forensics. Though those kind of debates is very interesting. They're really focused more on technical skill. They're not really focused so much, like when you do debate in high school or college, it's not so much about persuading a layperson as it is amassing a technical amount of points in a competition you hit an argument, you didn't drop an argument. So if you go online, so I'd encourage our viewers who probably watch, maybe you watch a William Lane Craig debate or one of my debates, look up high school Lincoln Douglas debate. And it's so very different from when you see like the debates that have been reviewed on your channel, because people will get up and they'll talk a mile a minute. You know, and this is the third point that was assessed by my opponent, because their goal is just to let the judge know I hit all my arguments, I replied to every counter argument, I didn't, and they have the, you know, these different techniques. So when I do debates, my goal is that's not my goal. My goal is to present the gospel, to present the truth of the faith. And my goal especially is to reach people who are on the fence, because every time you do a debate, unless the other person just starts convulsing and vomiting and passes out, there's always going to be a group of people that says that guy won. No matter how badly he does, he's always going to have, or she's always going to have, loyal defenders that will say that they won. And same for me. Unless I just like convulse and start vomiting, people will say that I won, even if I did a kind of a crummy job. But there are those people in the middle that I want to reach. So my background, I wasn't trained in forensic debating. The only training I got, I did this pro-life ministry called Justice for All, and I would go out to college campuses to dialogue about the issue of abortion. We would set up these graphic image displays. We would talk to students. One of the activities that we did was we would have an open microphone session. So we would have a microphone and ask people, hey, who wants to talk to us about the issue of abortion? And people would come up, and that was my first chance of essentially the cross-examination period of hearing an argument live, analyzing it for weaknesses, and trying to help the other person see they have an inconsistency. And so it was kind of a trial by fire. And then these things would also happen with atheism and other issues when I was on campus. So that's really where I learned a lot of these techniques and study. It was one from doing that when I was on college campuses. The other in my own conversion experience, studying other debaters, people like William Lane Craig, for example, though trying to add my own particular responses and style, because I think it's great to study if you would love debate, because you might be able to watch your channel, like, I want to do debates. I'm like, that's great. But what my encouragement would be, don't be Trent Horn, don't be William Lane Craig, don't be Nate Sollett. Be you, but you understand the rules of debate and you have your own particular style. That's what's really important.
That's good. That's actually great advice, you know, because on top of everything else that goes into debates, and in a second, I was going to ask you a little bit about your prep and what that looked like. But you know, you do need to work to your strengths. And, you know, one of the other aspects of being a good debater is developing, you know, what's called your ethos, pathos, logos, and having that connection with your judge slash audience, because in informal debates, it's the audience is the judge, you know. Yeah, playing up on what you're good at. And if you're a little bit more on the humorous side, like I am, you know, using that to your advantage. That's really good.
Yeah, I think that's important, because as I've done debates, and what you brought that up about logos, ethos, and pathos, or basically logic, emotion, and authority, you know, to understand why should I believe what you're saying, that when you do a debate, whoever you are, understand who you are, play to your strengths, and understand your weaknesses. So, for example, I would say that when people do debates, this just popped in my head. We'll see if it makes sense to you. There's kind of an inverse relationship between likability and aggressiveness. So you can have some debaters, they're very likable, but they may, and I think I might tend towards this more than other people. I mean, I don't want to toot my own horn. Sorry for the pun there. You know, there's some people that are very, they're like bulldogs. And this might come up when we talk about other people that I've engaged. And so they come with a very aggressive, assertive style. And that can have an advantage in that you can demonstrate a weakness in your opponent very quickly and clearly. But in having that aggressive, assertive style, a weakness that comes off with that is that you may appear unlikable to people who are kind of on the fence. Now, to flip that, if you're a very likable individual who wants to like strive to get along with others and it doesn't have as much of that aggressive tendency, then you may appeal to likability, but people might also think your argument comes off weaker if you're engaging a more aggressive person. So, and you could probably say this, and maybe you should explore this for another episode. People's personality traits, when they go into debates, they will have these kind of strengths and weaknesses. It's kind of like also you might say with like common sense thinking versus very philosophical. Very philosophical might help you dissect arguments. People might have a hard time, though, understanding you. But if you speak in a common sense way, people might rally behind you, but then more learned people will be like, this guy didn't damage the other guy's case at all. He didn't really say anything. Play to your strengths and be aware of your weaknesses and always work to grow with them.
So, I mean, this is going to be a kind of a loose, you know, we're going to float around. I'm tracking the discussion here because I think one of the things that I really do appreciate about you, especially now, because back when I was in the classroom, this was not really a reality. You know, I was in a north side of, by the way, do you mind if I ask, are you, so I'm in Las Vegas. Are you nearby or are you, where are you at?
I worked at Catholic Answers for a while in San Diego, California, but about a year ago, my family and I, we relocated to the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I had been to Vegas a few times though. We planned to move out of San Diego, I hate the cold. Like I lived in Kansas for 2 years and I'm just not a snow person. So it was really when we looked places to go, we thought about going back home to Phoenix where I lived for a while. Vegas was possibly an option, Florida. Then we settled on Dallas-Fort Worth because, you know, that's still a nice somewhere in the Sun Belt is where I had to go. But I've been to Vegas a few times. It's got some good stuff there, you know.
Well, you should have moved to Vegas. I get the sense we would have gotten along famously. But you know, just being in, so Vegas is kind of spread out, and in the north town, it's not really great. It's lower socioeconomic status and all of that. So I was at a school there with limited resources for debate. And so where I'm getting at is now I'm sort of looking at debates online where the camera is like right in your eye, you know? And so this really does come back to what you just said. And what I like about you is that you have your nonverbals are really controlled. You have an earnestness to you. You're not making a lot of, you got poker face, but in a good way. And so you come across as earnest, not really like a bulldog, like you said earlier. And that really does go a long way to benefit you.
Yes, I think that's helpful. Another comparison you could offer, because I think the most debates people watch in general, so, you know, let's say there's Christian atheist debates, but among the general public, the only debates people ever really see are probably the presidential debates, if you can call them debates, even, you know.
Right.
So it depends. But I remember many years ago, actually, in a lot of them, because in a lot of the presidential debates, they will show, and sometimes this happens in Christian apologetic debates, depending on the channel you're on. When one person's talking, they'll leave up your camera. and people see what you're doing. And right. so if you do these debates, you must always act like the camera is on you, even if you're not sure. Right. So I remember in the debates with Al Gore and George W. Bush back in the year 2000, one area where Gore stumbled a bit was that he came off very condescending. George Bush would say something and you could see him in the back going,
oh. Yeah,
that's just
right.
like this kind of stuff. And it comes off. You're right. If you don't have that control over yourself, it can come off, you know, that condescending or even like a kind of, you know, a lack of control. Now, it's okay to have some responses. In my debate with Alex O'Connor, one of my responses I couldn't hold in when he was talking turned into a little meme with people, because I gave a thought experiment about morality. And I said, you know, what about in this case, could you murder an innocent person to save your life? And Alex said, yeah, I think you could murder and cannibalize them. And I was getting a drink of my water when he said that. And I go, and I just do that. I have this beep, and someone turned it into a meme and people noticed that, like, I had this deadpan, like, wasn't expecting that.
Yeah.
All right. So, I mean, so you having, it's all about having that control. So poker face in general, neutral face. If your opponent says something like is just ridiculous and attacks you, it's instead of doing something like this, like, what an idiot, you should just smile and shake your head no, like, my goodness.
Right.
Or just give a smile and laugh, like, okay. Like, and I've seen William Lane Craig do that in some debates where someone says something ridiculous and he's just like,
yeah.
You know, to show that you've heard the objection, you recognize it's absurd, but you're not getting worked up over it.
Yeah, that's right. The worst thing you could do is go is have surprise face, like, oh, I wasn't ready for that. What's happening? You know, I'm losing it. Then that's bad.
Yeah.
But
yeah, no, you have to push that feeling deep down inside if you are feeling that.
Right?
And you could, in that case, maybe you could offer a quizzical look. And I have been in situations like that before. My opponent just says something totally out of left field. I'm like, where is this going? And then just proceed to writing notes or pensively thinking. But yeah, it's debate in general, to do it well, you have to have control over your nonverbals and control of your thought. And of course, control over your speech and planning what you choose to say in response.
That's right. That's right. So, I mean, in light of that, the next question that I had for you was about your prep time or your prep in general. Like, what do you do to prepare for a debate?
Well, usually what I do is once we've agreed upon a resolution, I start in a variety of ways. Usually first I build up my opening statement. And what's hard is, and I always do this, I'll have my opening statement done, let's say a few weeks beforehand, but I still end up tinkering with it the night before because I'm like, oh, this isn't working as well. Or so I'll work on my opening statement. I read the opening statement aloud and I offer myself about 30 seconds of cushion to make sure I'm not up against the wire to finish. So I'll read it and I'll read it aloud multiple times to make sure it sounds correct. It's easy to follow, easy to understand. I'm familiar with it. So I will put that forward to be very prepared, and I will go through the opening statement and I'll make sure to cut the fat. I want to stick with the arguments. And the goal here is arguments and evidences. Every Right. now and then, especially if my opponent is famous for a particular argument, sometimes in the opening statement, I will put a preemptive strike. You shouldn't try to anticipate every objection and log that into your opening statement. It's better to put forward your evidence for your case. But every now and then, if I know my opponent will phrase things in a certain way or make things confusing for people, I will offer, and this is especially the case if I am the affirmative and I go first, I'll offer a preemptive strike to say, my opponent often puts things this way, but remember A, B, and C. And that gives the audience another way of looking at his opening statement. That way they say, oh, I see what he's doing here. That way they're analyzing his opening statement with my preferred lens. So what's interesting is when you do debates, I had somebody was talking with me, they were saying, I want to do a debate with you, but could I open and then speak last? And I said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Yeah. Because there's a trade-off there. When you speak first, you get the advantage of setting that framework, you know, setting a lens for people to view the negative's opening statement. So you do have an advantage there, but you also have a disadvantage that the affirmative carries the burden of proof. The negative can just fold his arms and and we'll get up when we talked about a particular debater here soon, just say, I'm not convinced.
Right.
You shouldn't be convinced. It's not good enough. The negative just has to cast doubt. So traditionally, it's easier to be the negative. But the affirmative can also put so much out there, the negative can't really shoot it all down. The negative has an advantage, though, in that he gets to speak last. So he gets to have the closing statement. Now, you shouldn't cheat. I'll tell you one thing, Nate. In many of my debates, the thing that's most frustrating is nearly everyone I've debated has cheated at one point in the debate.
Mm. Okay.
So I'll give the most common examples is when we do Q&A, the question and answer with the audience, usually it's 2 minutes for one person to answer, 1 minute for the other person to respond. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I cannot tell you how many times I've been in a debate where I, you know, that guy gave their 2 minutes and I gave my 1 minute counter reply, and then he pipes up and says something else, which is against the rules.
Yeah.
You had your turn. We need to keep it even. Or in the closing statement, when my opponent will present a new argument. Now, this happened to me in my debate on the deuterocanonical books of scripture, or as Protestants call them, the Apocrypha, the Old Testament canon. That my opponent, he threw a new argument in his closing statement. And I said, that's false. I'm not going to respond at length because he shouldn't do that. That's against the rules. So what I do at the debate, I craft the opening statement real well, trim it up. Then what I do after that is I try to understand my opponent as much as I can. Like I want to know him or her better than they know themselves. So I'll watch their debates. I will read their books. And so in doing that and researching the topic and understanding where they come from, then I will craft rebuttals, and they will be, usually I'll keep them as notes. Sometimes I'll keep them in a Word document and I'll be able on the fly when I'm talking to the person, I might jot down what they say in opening, and then I'll slot it into a rebuttal. Sometimes I have a rebuttal pre-written because I'm going to take a good gamble, a sense of what they're going to do.
Right.
And the key with debate for preparation, well, the key with doing a good debate is preparation, preparation, preparation. If you do That's it off right. the top of your head, you're just not going to do as well. You just won't. The more you're prepared, the better it's going to go. So with the rebuttals, I will take advantage of this. And I think this might come up more when we talk about my debate with James White. So like when my debate with James White, I had not just prepared rebuttals, I had prepared rebuttal slides available I dropped in. And so I noticed this actually, that when I went up with my computer, even the second rebuttal to offer my replies, he kind of threw up his hands, seeing that I had, that I had this and was ready to walk people through what he had said. So that's what I'll do next is I will really immerse myself in the other person so much so I'm kind of sick of them by the time the debate gets here, if they have a paper and debate trail. And so what's hard is this is another paired benefit disadvantage. So I've debated some people like James White or Dan Barker, who are very practiced. They've done debates since like before I was born. So they have a style. They've done it a bunch. So it comes second nature to them. So that's an advantage. A disadvantage, though, and this is something I tried to play on in my two debates with Dan Barker, was that when people do things over and over again, they fall into patterns. And so they become predictable, and you're able to anticipate what they're going to do and have kind of a ready reply for that. So I basically just do that. I also, spend time in prayer and try to just be, focused on what I am attempting to do in this situation. And then, just try to be prepared, have some prepared cross-examination questions that I think will be most fruitful. And then it's funny, like the day of the debate, I can't get anything done at work because I'm too focused. I'm like, today's shot. I just want the debate to be over already. And then you get up and you do it. But that's mostly how I try to build up my case and then just try to be aware of standard rebuttals and then the things that are unique to what my opponent might bring.
Yeah. I mean, it's great because not having had more formal training like in school and stuff like that, you're explaining everything that we would go through in the classroom, laying a framework, flowing, so flowing is like taking notes during a debate. When your opponent is saying something, you're jotting it down, and research is key. Like if you can anticipate, because I mean, the thing with me and my students was we would always do drills, a lot of practice debates. And it was always understood that whenever you're given a topic in a debate, you got to write argument briefs from both sides. And then you won't know going in, we'll flip a coin and then you know how you're going to debate. Right. But that's anticipation. Yes. That's everything you're saying.
Yeah, that's right. And so the key is to know your other opponent's side and his arguments extremely well so that you can counter them. And then be prepared on your end to focus on what you're debating. A key, and I've done well and not as well in certain areas when I haven't focused on this. Like if you're defending a resolution, focus on the resolution. Don't let your opponent trick you into going into a side trail on things where he might be ready to clobber you if it's not a crucial part of your resolution. You can say, well, that is a very interesting topic. But it's not related to what we're talking about today. So if you're a Christian and you're debating the existence of God, or even, you know, whether did Jesus rise from the dead, your atheist opponent might say, so my opponent believes in the Bible, but you know the Bible says that that Christians can burn people at the stake, or that the Israelites can slaughter men, women, and children. It's a trap, you know, to quote Admiral Akbar from Return of the Jedi, because then... If you're sucked into debate, because he's, even if you feel confident, he purposely brought that up because he knows it's easier for him to hit you on those points, and it detracts from the case you're trying to present. So you have to be careful to not be sucked into those side venues. But it's all about preparation. I'll give you an example that when I debated Dan Barker, a former pastor turned atheist, author of the book Godless, we debated once. It was like my first public debate. Still pretty green. Then we debated a second time at the University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And Barker did what I thought he would, that I studied his previous debates, and he hit point for point, same thing. Now, he had overwhelmed previous Christian opponents that we were debating, does the Christian God exist? Mm-hmm. So what Barker did was he did something, and this is helpful for people to know in debate parlance. This is originally called the Gish Gala. So Dwayne Gish was a young earth creationist. And when he would debate people on evolution, he would just have like 20 arguments against evolution and, you know, run through them quickly. And it's hard to go back through all of them. And you say, well, you didn't get all of them, so I win. So Barker kind of did that with Bible difficulties and contradictions. His whole case was, does the Christian God exist? No. Here's all of this stuff in the Bible that is difficult or doesn't make sense. So I practiced very hard and crafted first my opening statement. I was a preemptive strike against that approach, saying it's not relevant. And actually, I remember that debate, I ended right on the buzzer, right at 15. And then in the rebuttal, my rebuttal was trimmed as well. That entire rebuttal was pre-written. I knew exactly what he was going to do. And so because of that, I was able to neutralize all. The problem with the Gish Gallop is, it's good. Except if your opponent catches everything and throws it back, now you're under the same weight to reply, and you've gotten yourself into trouble. So there, the preparation really paid off.
Oh, that's good. That's good. He couldn't come back with anything.
No, he was not able to catch up after that. He could have if I was unable to reply to his arguments, but I was able to reply, I think, to almost every substantive objection. He just was, because he was just, here's a Bible verse. Boy, doesn't that sound bad. Here's the next one. Right. Here's a Bible verse. Oh, boy, doesn't that sound bad. So because he doesn't elaborate on them, I can say, actually, this makes sense for X, and not even be that lengthy in my reply, but then just hit it point by point and then throw that back to him.
So one of the things that I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. One of the things that I would teach my students, there was a kind of a cliche saying floating around at the time. And the more I thought about it, I was like, my goodness, I really do think this is true. Because we talk about frameworks, and framework is really just narrating, the way I define it is narrating the debate, narrating the discussion to your audience so that they can better understand what's going on, especially like really technical topics and discussions, narrating it to them so that they have a way to think through the debate. But you're also you're bringing them over to your side because you're narrating it in a way that's advantageous to your position. And so
from my point of view,
exactly. And which is what you've done. Right. And you're going to hear from my opponent in a minute, and he's going to say X, Y, and Z. And here's why that's wrong or wrongheaded. But so here's the cliche statement, and I'm curious to get your thought. The one who lays a better framework more often than not wins. regardless of any other thing, you know, like whether the arguments are more valid than the other, none of that. It's the one who lays a better framework. What do you think about that in your experience?
No, I think that's correct. That when people walk away from the debate, they want a story in their head about what happened. You know, they hear arguments back and forth, and it's very difficult to keep up with all of the arguments. But I think it's important. And one person who's very good at this is William Lane Craig, that when he does a debate, he'll say, I presented five arguments. My opponent didn't reply to three of them. And two of them, here's what was wrong with his objection. I've given evidence to show it's reasonable to believe in God. My opponent never showed there were good reasons to either not believe and no reasons my arguments don't work. And, you know, so just walking people through. So I'll do this. And you're right. My debates where I have failed to do this, they don't go as well as debates where I'm very disciplined and focused to say, here is what I am presenting, especially if I am the negative, to hammer home. My opponent needed to prove X. Did he prove X? No, because of A, B, and C. And then when I have the affirmative to say, my argument is that we should believe X, this is true. I gave all of these reasons, but my opponent ignored these reasons and didn't really show what was wrong with these reasons. And also to give a framework of what's very helpful is if you can say, and I think this came up in my debate with Jay Dyer on natural theology, to say, look, my opponent, he is either going to, in saying Christians should not practice natural theology, he's either doing natural theology in reverse, because he's a presuppositionalist, or he's fallaciously begging the question. It has to be one of the two. And so when you say my opponent is doing one of these two unacceptable things, so that you can see what we're each doing. Or in my debate with James White, he got a little perturbed, I think, when I said, my opponent is reading his theology into the Bible, and I want to believe the Bible should speak for itself. And then he got up and he told everyone, this is a Catholic who tells you this, people, who believes in the Assumption of Mary. And I see he was really irked by that. Yeah. But in my debate with him, I was actually very particular in my opening statement to not cite. I did not make this a Catholic-Protestant debate, because the topic that we were debating, eternal security, is something Protestants disagree about and have different views. So that's why I made it very clear. I'm going to cite the Bible and Roger Olson or Martin Luther or Robert Gagnon or other Protestant scholars. I'm talking about just a historic Christian position. And I felt that White, in bringing that up, I don't know, people can take it as they will. One might interpret that move as poisoning the well, as letting people know, like, hey, look where this gentleman's arguing from. It'll take you down a road you may not want to go, you know? So, I mean, but that's what I tried to do, is have a framework. Say, here's how James White will argue, but here's problem A and problem B. And I think that's important. I think you're absolutely right that you need to have a framework. And more importantly, people are like, what's a framework? I don't get it. You need to tell the more persuasive story about what happened in the debate.
Yeah,
basically.
That's right. That's right. So I was going to bring this up. I'm glad that you did, because I was very happy to see that that's what you did, and unhappy to see, you know. So here's the thing: in the videos, I can't do full debates. It would be like a 4-hour. Nobody's going to watch this Mr. Potato Head talk about anything for 4 hours. So, like, I have to zoom in on something that's a little bit more spicy, which is cross-exam. But going back to your opening statements, when James White made it, he didn't make the whole thing about it, but he did bring up Protestantism versus Roman Catholicism. And I go, no, that's not what the topic is about. So for you to come back and say, this isn't that. And then a lot of your evidence was Protestants against James White. I was like, that was so brilliant. You know, good for you.
And that's very helpful when you do debates. When you pick your sources, try to select neutral or opposing sources as much as possible. So let's say you're debating an atheist. What's more persuasive is not you quote J.P. Moreland or William Lane Craig as to why this atheist argument is bad. Quote Graham Oppie, J.L. Mackey, or Richard Dawkins, or Christopher Hitchens. You find a well-known atheist who can say the particular argument your atheist opponent is offering is not good. Because then it's like, oh, wow, even people on that side recognize the problem here. And that really means a lot for people who are on the other side watching, like, oh, wow, I didn't know that Christopher Hitchens or or Graham Oppie or someone thought that this is just not a really good argument. And so that's right. why I, when I was engaging White, I was very focused to not turn it into a Catholic Protestant debate. And also, I mean, I was actually debating in front of 1,200 Calvinists at the G3 conference to not get up there and be the snarky Catholic taking shots at Protestants. Well, I would love for them to look into the truth of the Catholic faith at another time, probably, but to be present and be that ambassador. And much the same way to make an analogy, if you're going to be a Christian debater, don't get up there taking your little pot shots at atheism because you want to win these people over to Christ.
That's
you
right.
know, be
That's right.
Don't let yourself like getting snarky and taking jabs at people. You don't want to do that. It's fine to offer a little backhanded compliment or something if your opponent is being belligerent or is being a little bit over the top. But always keep in mind your audience comes first.
That's good. That's so good. And actually, it's something that touches on where I'm going in a minute. But so here, sure. we're sort of been tippy-toeing around this for a little while. One of the most requested videos that people ask me, because every week people will vote and tell me, hey, we want you to do this one. And I missed all of these debates when I was in the classroom. So I'm coming to these fresh, a lot of these.
Sure.
But one of the most requested was you versus Matt Dillahunty on whether the resurrection is reasonable. You did a really great job. There was a moment. So my read on Matt Dillahunty is that he is somebody who plays different roles in the debate when it suits him best. Like, so for example, like when you pin him up against the wall, intellectually speaking, as a debater, he'll shift and he'll put on the audience member hat. And all of a sudden he says, well, you haven't convinced me. It's like, well, no, that's right. not his job to sit here and be like that. Like he's supposed to argue back. Right. So like, what is your take on Matt Dillahunty as a debater?
Yeah, I think that Matt Dillahunty, what's interesting, he reminds me of like how some pastors who are have a good use of rhetoric when they use apologetics in Christian debates, that they don't focus so much on arguments. They've got clever quips and turns of phrases to go after their opponent. So I think when it comes to being a debater, now what was interesting in my exchange with Matt Dillahunty, you might have noticed at the beginning of that, Matt Fratton, the moderator, and I and Matt were kind of talking back and forth because I thought we were going to be doing that with formal rounds and rebuttals, not an extended dialogue period. So the format changed on me. It didn't change on me. I overlooked that in the emails. And because my previous debate on Matt Fratton's channel had been a different format. I assumed it would just be the same format as the previous debate I had done there. There's another rule for your would-be debaters. Read the fine print. You don't want to show up and it's a completely different format because doing 45-minute dialogue is way different than having rebuttal rounds. You have to prepare very differently. So,
right.
But I still engaged him. And I think what Matt does, it's interesting in his different formats that I feel like sometimes he feels comfortable calling out weaknesses in other people's arguments. But if he feels a bit overwhelmed by things, he'll either do what others have called the Dillahunty dodge, which is, I'm just not convinced. And that's what Matt did when he said, I said, you know, is it reasonable to believe that Jesus existed? And he said, well, I'm not convinced, or I'm sure. And I interrupted him and said, Matt, I'm not asking about you. Yeah. I'm asking in general about people in general. This is not about you. And that's important because some people, when they debate him, Matt does well if he treats the debate as the debate was, can Matt Dillahunty be convinced God exists? I wasn't convinced, so I win.
That's
of course, that's a great topic. I wish I could have a topic. Is Trent Horn convinced of atheism? No, I won. You know?
There you go.
But, so I think that when it's structured, when people have an opportunity to point out the problematic elements, and they also have to be careful because, as I said earlier, Matt, in some cases, not it's just in the cases when he does this, he becomes kind of a bulldog. That he becomes, and in cross-examination, it's okay to interrupt people, but it's not a license just to be a total like steamroller to other people. And that's why when that happens to you, to not be flustered, and that's why I kind of made light of it in the discussion to say, you know, are you just going to pontificate, Matt? Are you going to let me give an answer? How am I supposed to answer your question if you won't let me answer?
Right.
Just to let him know, like, you know, you're doing this because you just don't want people to hear what I have to say. So I think that it was helpful. And I think especially for people on the fence, you go through the comments it's interesting with Matt, like whenever he goes and does debates, there's like 100,000 Matt Dillahunty fans that follow him because he'll go to an obscure channel and do a debate. And that channel will be like 2,000 views, 180,000 views. So I'm like, oh, Matt brings a sizable audience with him to watch these things. And they'll watch him like, oh, Trent got destroyed, this and that. But I'm more interested in the people on the fence when they read through things, say like, I don't think Matt really understands history very well. That he doesn't understand like how history works and, you know, things like that. So, and that was similar to my debate with Alex O'Connor, seeing people saying like, I didn't think that was his best one and I'm an atheist. So that's what I look for.
Yeah, no, that's good. And for that sort of subsection of the audience, right? The little things, quote unquote, the little things really do matter. And so going back to nonverbals, there was just a moment that stuck out to me where I was like, dang, man, that is so good. And the thing is, like, I can't handle my nonverbals. I have various backgrounds, you know, and one of them, I probably shouldn't mention this. It's going to be very embarrassing, but is acting a little bit for 5 seconds. But
go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
But, you know, you got to be expressive in your face. And so to bring that into an environment where you have to have a poker face, I can't do that really well. There was a moment in your debate where Matt Dillahunty, he said something like, oh, my God, you know, like, why are you bringing up Alex O'Connor?
When I brought up Alex O'Connor. That's right.
Yeah. And this is what you did. You stopped. No change of expression on your face. And you go, what's wrong? And I was like, that is so good, man, because it looks like Dillahunty is the one who is being weird. And he was.
He's getting emotional. He was. And I think that's where it gets interesting to compare, because that's one of the few exchanges where even many atheists say that Matt did not do very well. It was when Matt and Alex had an informal, they're like in a hotel room having an informal conversation about ethical veganism, about whether we ought to be vegans, and Matt isn't. And so what was interesting in that exchange, because it was in person, it was just like in a hotel room and they're just chatting and their friends are both atheist pals, you would imagine. And so Matt was kind of inhibited from bringing out his bulldog that he uses when he's in trouble to try to like steamroll the other person. So he was doing a lot of dodging and seemed to be in a corner, couldn't really answer Alex in that regard. And other atheists called him out on that. And so I think that so that's why I was bringing up, because the prompt for the debate with Matt was specific. Now, I thought it would be helpful, more than arguing did Jesus rise from the dead, I really focus on, is it reasonable to believe it? Mm-hmm. And that's a very different prompt to say, look, and that's why I asked Matt, something could be reasonable and you choose to not believe in it.
That's right.
That's fine. And so that's that. And what that does is, as the affirmative, it lowers the burden of proof for me. I don't have to prove that this happened. I just have to prove you're not a crazy person for believing in it. It's a good first step for some people who think it is crazy. And so it's baby steps for people. And so that's why I wanted to show that Matt has a big problem. Matt Dillahunty has a big problem. If he can't distinguish between something being reasonable and something being convincing, because what Matt does, here we go. This is the insight with Matt Dillahunty. He'll do his debates and he thinks he's proven Christianity is not reasonable because it's not convincing to him, but they're not the same thing. And a lot of people just think that those are the same thing. So I tried hard in that debate to show they're not the same. You got to give a reason to think this is unreasonable beyond just you're not convinced.
No, that's excellent. I mean, that's exactly what I would do. So, you know, good for you. Good for you. One of the other most requested videos was your debate with James White on internal security. Now, I did, I was very apprehensive to do that. I did another, if I can characterize it this way, I did another one. Put it this way. I'm much more comfortable doing Christians versus atheists. I'm not comfortable doing more, you know, we're on the same team. Yeah, exactly. So, cause I did it before and, it was on election or something like that. And boy, the people's, various audience members came out and against me and all that stuff.
I think you had a very fair review and closing verdict on the debate with White and I. But if you had another thought, go ahead.
Well, I concluded as such. But I mean, feel free to take up some time and
Your evaluation of it, I thought was fair to look at. What it reminded me of, and your evaluation of it. It reminded me of the first Rocky movie, when Rocky fights Apollo Creed. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. And I was actually somewhat nervous going into that debate with James White. This was actually my very first Catholic Protestant debate. Prior to that, I had only debated really on atheism or abortion or did Jesus exist. So this was my first invitation to do a debate on a Catholic Protestant issue. And it's with James White, who his reputation precedes him as a debater. So I prepared a lot for it, but I was still nervous. And I feel like now reflecting on it 4 years later, if I could go back and do things, I would certainly do things differently in the cross-examination to focus the argument more, you know, always little things like that. But overall, so your analysis of it, so like going in, it was kind of like, you know, Rocky is just like this boxer from, you know, the streets of Philadelphia, and he's going to fight Apollo Creed, you know, and then right. they get in the ring and suddenly it's like, hey, Rocky has some punches Apollo Creed was not expecting. Like, this yeah. is not a knockout you would think of someone who's the veteran versus the rookie. And so yeah. they're do, you know, and so in the movie, of course, Rocky, everyone thinks, you know, oh yeah, Rocky, when he beats Apollo Creed. No, he does not beat Apollo Creed in Rocky. Yeah. At the end of the match, it is a split decision where two of the refs technically say Apollo Creed because it didn't end in a knockout. So when, right. and that's interesting, like when you have a debate, very few debates end with a knockout.
Right.
A debate where the other person is knocked out, I actually feel kind of bad for those situations. I feel like it's almost like not fair you right. know, to have someone who's so poorly prepared or just gets completely walked over. That so like in boxing, you can win a boxing match via knockout mm-hmm. or via technical knockout, or, you know, through the judges will tally up the hits, the body blows, the
right.
deflections. And so like in Rocky, it's a split decision. So I think people might come away from my debate with James White as split decision. Some people will side yeah. more with you or side with others. But overall, I feel good because it's pretty good that Rocky was able to do that. And I felt good like, hey, this is my first Catholic Protestant debate with someone who has a lot of experience in this regard. And I think it yeah. gave a lot of people a lot to think about on that particular position I was defending. And my other goal was just for people to have a favorable view towards a Catholic defending Catholic doctrine, showing that we care very deeply about scripture and that I want to follow the scriptures and exegete them and present them well to others. And so even if that is just my only goal, I'm happy with that coming out there. But it's always fun though to see when it's like being an athlete or whatever, you do the play-by-play, you look and say, oh, that was a good landing. I didn't stick the landing there. And you yeah. always have to look and then learn and grow and look forward to the next one, basically.
No, I appreciate that. You're being very kind and very, very even-handed with this kind of thing, because I really thought about it later. And I mean, for anybody wondering, like, these are my fresh reactions. I'm not, you know, I think there's always somebody, but somebody said in the comment, like, oh, this guy must be watching these thousands of times. No, I'm really just going in fresh. Like, I'm going to do the White. Well, as of this recording, I'm going to do the White, what, Craig, the unbelievable thing.
Oh, yes.
I'm going to do that soon, this Friday. And mm-hmm. so yeah. I haven't seen it. I people are like, hey, man, don't tell me. I want to go in Fred. I don't know, you know, but and I really do get the sense that the Rocky thing is so apropos, man. Like, that is what it was. Like, it was so close. I really do feel like if I watched it again, I'd say you won. Like, that's how right. close it was. It was so good. It felt so good to watch. It was just really great.
Yeah. And I think that it's helpful to see that. Though in general, though, it's interesting. And if you're going to do this, by the way, people, and I'd love to see more people to debate. What's hard is I get kind of jealous of the Protestant world because, like, there's a lot of people who want to study. And it seems like there's a fair number of Protestants who want to get out there and do debate or dialogue on at least what we would call mere Christianity, the existence of God, resurrection right. of Jesus. And I get kind of, like, I'm trying to kick Catholics to get their butt in gear to do that kind of stuff. Because,
yeah.
I mean, the people that I know who go out and want to do this and debate and will engage others on this. I mean, you've got like the philosopher types like William Lane Craig or J.P. Moreland or others like Frank Turek or J. Warner Wallace, or even people like, you know, like Braxton Hunter, like, hey, good job. You're getting out there and doing that. Mm-hmm. And then I look out in the Catholic world and it's like tumbleweeds. Like, they'll sometimes do debates on like Catholic Protestant stuff. I'm like, yeah. guys, we got to defend like the core essence of this. Mm-hmm. So, Yeah, but it's otherwise it's good to see, and that's why it's always important just to try to learn from what you're doing to grow and to teach others to manifest this in a gracious way. If I get hit by a bus?
maybe it's just one of those things where you're a little bit ahead of the curve. And you'll be the model that others see, and then before you know it, 5-10 years down the road, we'll have a lot of Trent Horns out there. You know,
that's what's important if you want to do this kind of, because the other temptation, because I think this is helpful, because I'm sure there's some people watching your channel who would love to do this stuff, and if they're called to it, they should do that. And there's ways to tell that. You can pray and have an internal call, but one way of telling if you're called to do this is really going to be the reviews. You really have to look at them, and you have to be honest about it. If you're not, because I have seen some people who go and do debates like this, and I think they do a disservice. Like, this is not their skill set, and they should focus on something else. Now, you're not always going to bat 1,000, but I think in general, if you're getting general positive reviews, like when they had that engagement with White, I felt like it went well because I went and looked at comments and reviews and saw a wide variety of them. The most interesting reviews for me on debates are from people who don't have a dog in the fight. It's rare to find it, but sometimes you can. Yeah. So, for example, like with White, I looked up a Mormon apologist who, probably is still closer to my view, but is still somewhat far removed, saying, yeah, I think that Trent actually, had this here. And then seeing that White sometimes will do, sometimes you can tell how a debate went by looking, and this is something you might want to comment on in a future episode. A new trend is people will offer debriefs or reviews of the debates that they did. Mm-hmm. And so that's something new that I've seen. And I noticed that in White's review of our debate, it was not as celebratory as I had seen in like when he talks about other debates that he's done and talks about them. And so sometimes I can get that. There's a lot more explaining about how to when you have to say to explain how to understand a debate, it's like you may not feel it went as well as you would have hoped. Although I will say when it comes to debate reviews, I think those are fine to do. I mean, especially like what you do is you're third party, let's take a look at this. If you review your own debate, it's fine. Right. Just don't use it. I've seen some people where they like played the whole debate and gave a commentary. I'm like, dude, you're redoing the debate, man. You gotta let go.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
No, that's really great. It just gets me thinking, there's just a lot more. Well, I mean, here's the thing too. This is not where the debate teacher thing was a gimmick. So I don't know if I'm breaking people's hearts, but this is not where my heart is. Like the debate teacher thing was a way to get people more aware of the ministry that I've established for years. The ministry is more on evangelism, effective evangelism techniques, discipleship and things like that. So, but there is the more I look at this, there really is a broad realm of categories and videos that you could possibly do under this little niche that you and I are discussing right now. So,
and I think it's important, like what you're doing, because I say, well, how is this evangelism? He's sitting around ranking debates or things like that. Right. No, it is, because when people say, like, why do you do debates? I tell them, I actually don't do debates in order to end the discussion on a topic, but to start it. Because I always counsel people, a debate is not a good way to arrive at the truth of a subject. Because you could have a subject where you've got a true and a false position, but the true position is defended by someone who doesn't know how to debate. So they don't defend it very well. So it's a reflection on the performance of the debaters. So why do we do debates then? Well, because they're entertaining. They're entertaining and they get us interested in an issue. Like, let's say you're going to do the review of White and Craig on Calvinism, Molinism. Way more people are going to watch that than will read an article analyzing the theological significances of Calvinism and Molinism on the question of divine foreknowledge. Few people are going to read an article like that, but it's fun to watch two people spar on that. And so what I see is that the debates, especially people on the fence, whether it's Christianity or atheism, whatever it is, if you're on the fence, I want to figure out more of these arguments and these things. So it gets people more into the subject to do that. That's my goal, is to get people more fascinated by the subject to do their own research and investigation. But hopefully as they do it, they have a partiality to the side I've represented because of the technique that I use and the evidence I presented.
Right. That's great. That's great. Do we have a few more minutes? I know we're running up on time here.
Yeah, actually, I got a lot of time. Don't stress. This is fun. It's fun to talk shop with people. Plus, I work from home, so I don't get to talk to grownups very much.
Oh, excellent. All right. I feel like we're the same age. I'm 42. I don't want you to call yourself out there, but I feel like we're relatively the same age. So,
I think we're a part of the same. I think that I'm a geriatric millennial, and so you would be a baby Gen Xer, basically, right. is where we would be. Because I'm going to be 37 in January, so we're around that same time period. So.
Yeah, we have a lot of shared experiences, I'm sure, growing up in late 80s, early 90s. Well, so then let me close with a couple questions about evangelism, because that's like I said, that's where I'm at. What is coming out of all the debates that you've done, what is like your favorite go-to argument or thing to say in regular conversations?
Oh, you mean my favorite thing to say just if I'm talking to people about the faith?
Yeah, or like you're engaging regular folk, not an interlocutor on stage, but just regular folk.
Yeah. Well, honestly, my favorite thing to say is more to ask them my favorite question to ask them. Which would be some, and so this would be borrowed a lot from the Christian apologist Greg Kokel and his work Tactics, to say, because when you talk to people, even when I'm in a debate, I sometimes will pose questions for people rather than statements. Like in my debate with White, to say, well, how do you know a Bible passage about the loss of salvation is prescriptive rather than descriptive? And then what method do you use to objectively determine that? Rather than saying, he's wrong about passage 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And I did do that. But to say, you know, I pose that question. Someone's like, oh, yeah. Well, how? How would I be able to determine that? When you leave someone with a question that bothers them, it's more effective, I think, even than a very solid argument. So more what I want to leave people with is, how do you know X is true? How, or at least, how did you come to believe that? Or a question I sometimes like to ask them is, that's really interesting. What do you think is the strongest argument against that view? And what would you say to it?
Right.
And then if they can't answer, it's, and I talk to atheists a lot about this, because it's very hard to get atheists, like, no set of premises is just going to lead, there's a God, like, right there. It's always going to be like, that's just your little silly little argument.
Yeah.
Okay, well, what do you think is the best argument or best reason, and what's wrong with it? Or what would convince you? Like, what kind of evidence would? I find it's very important in conversations and also in debates to this as well. Leave someone with a question that causes them to doubt a pillar of a false belief that they hold. Mm-hmm. And then that will leave room for your true belief to aid that person to come to know the truth.
No, that's excellent. And that's exactly what I would advocate for as well, is there's more of a, well, to bring it over, you know, like from using like debate language, cross-examination is a lot more effective in a regular guise or in a regular setting than making a, you know, affirmative, constructive, you know, an opening statement. Because when it comes to, so maybe you can let me know what you think about this, but when it comes to people, especially those who they're talking about difficult subjects, religion, Christianity, especially, that's not very popular anymore to just walk up to people cold and talk about. So you're dealing with barriers, defenses, people are very defensive. And so like you're trying to overcome those barriers, you can do so much better with a gentle cross-examination style question than a statement.
Right. Absolutely. So instead of talking about a controversial point of Christian morality, you can ask, oh, okay, well, what do you think morality is? Do you think it's something that like we invented or we discovered it? Because like if we discovered it, we can't really change it. If we invented it, we could change it, but it doesn't seem like we could just all decide to make it really bad. Or if we did, you say, oh, well, we could. And I say, okay, well, if people did, would you go along with it or not? Well, I go with my personal moral code. Okay, well, how do you know when your personal moral code is right or wrong? You know, like, have you ever done something where you felt guilty? It sounds like you're, you know, if you are the source of the code, you can always just kind of change it so you don't feel bad. And so there you go. So you're asking. So there you're not boxed in on a controversial point they're having a hard time with. You're going back to basics and back to the foundational levels.
Right. And again, as you know, Christians, I would say we need to do work exegeting the scriptures, obviously, but I think as Christians, especially today, we should exegete people. And if we do that, then we see that there's this other thing that's going on. And I'm not saying it's a good thing, but a lot of us really walk around the world thinking that we're master and commander of our own vessel. And so, you know, Galileo said a long time ago, you cannot teach a man anything. You know, ladies in the audience, you know what I'm talking about, right? You cannot teach a man anything. You can only help him to find it within himself. And so, again, asking those questions leads them there, but they think they're the ones doing it.
Right. And you're guiding them down that path. And that's why it's important that we know as Christians that we do not have the power to convert people. Only the Holy Spirit can bring someone to faith. But what we can do is we can remove obstacles to receiving the Holy Spirit and give people questions that prime them, so to speak, to be open to that movement of the Spirit in their life. And that's our role. As St. Paul says in the letter to the Corinthians, we are, I think it's 1 Corinthians 3, we are God's co-workers. And then we, you know, in planting field, it says we are his co-workers. Now we don't, we aren't involved in moving someone to the moment of salvation, but we do prepare the path so the Spirit can move them to that.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I think we're already kind of touching on this. So, because we're talking about elements of debates that can actually help us in regular conversation. Not a lot of us are going to be on stage doing this kind of a thing in a formal sense, but definitely all of us can get out there and fulfill the Great Commission with the people that God has placed in our lives. So what are some ways, though, that, like, you can't just take a debate and drop it right down on top of a regular conversation? So, like, what are some ways that debates can, like, not help us or hinder us in regular conversations?
Sure. Well, they can hinder us if we treat interpersonal conversations like debates. That's a bad idea. So, for example, like, when I do debates, my goal is not to cause Dan Barker or Matt Dillahunty to become Christian or James White to become Catholic. That would be an excellent bonus if that were to happen, but I'm not counting on it. My goal is to reach those people sitting on the fence who are listening in, and that they come away and say, that guy had a lot of good information and he was confident and he didn't lash out at the other guy. I want to see more of what he has to say. So even if I'm, you know, kind of having a little fun a little bit, or, you know, with my opponent, or back and forth playfulness, it's okay, because, you know, I'm more playing to the people watching. But the problem is, those people, if I talk to them, I do not treat them like a debate opponent. For I really do hope that I have a reasonable chance of, if they're on the fence and having a conversation with them, a friend, a family member, to help them to see what is what I believe, and they come to believe it. And also, I have an added benefit. My debate, I've got 2 hours. That's it. With this person, I have ideally a relationship, so I can take it at a slow pace. Because in a debate, you've got to rock, you've got to run hard. You've got a 15-minute opening statement. Get it all in there. And if you don't get it in there, tough. But in a real relationship, I can take baby steps with the person. I can walk them through it step by step. You know, so I'm not in a debate, I'm toe-to-toe. So you cannot take that in a conversation. Conversation is shoulder to shoulder, that I'm walking alongside this individual. So now I do think debates can serve a role here. Like, when you're engaging people in conversation, you might say, yeah, it was really good talking about this. Hey, by the way, you might want to watch this debate. Like, I might send people my debate with Alex O'Connor or Ben Watkins on atheism. So you might want to watch this, because they might be more willing to watch a debate than like a talk on something they disagree with. Because at least they get to see their guy up there, and, you know, and then you can, you can engage one another in that regard. So I think that in our interpersonal conversations, treating them like debates will hinder evangelism. You have to treat them as dialogue and as baby steps in conversation. And that's something that I touched on before, would just be, debates can hinder evangelization if you're bad at them, or you're uncharitable, or the worst combination, you're both bad and uncharitable. It's like, I don't know which I would, I don't know. I think I'd rather have a charitable person who's not super intelligent than a smart person that everyone just thinks is a total jackass. I don't know. It's a hard one. I personally would rather be someone that someone thinks that, I'm wrong about this, rather than, it's hard. I don't know, because sometimes I feel like I would want them to think Christianity is true. I would rather have them think Christianity is true and I'm a jackass, than that I'm nice and Christianity is false. Like, I would rather make that sacrifice. But on the other hand, I feel like being un-Christ-like can push yeah. people away further than just a mere absence of knowledge. I guess here is why. I feel like it's easier, like if you come across someone who is an ill-informed, nice Christian, it's easier to fix that with information later. I met a Christian, they were super nice, but yeah. they don't really know a lot. And I say, oh, well, he didn't know about this. Oh, wow, that's really good information to know. It's easier to fix a lack of information. It's harder to fix a lack of charity. You run yeah. into one Christian who's a jackass. That's just a fun word to say. no matter how many other nice Christians you put out there afterwards, that one still sticks with you. And it's hard to shake. So I think that that would be, yes, I would prefer a person to be charitable and ill-informed because it is easier to fix the lack of information later and get them to all these great resources that are out there. But in general, so if you want to do debates, you have to make sure you are informed and you're charitable. And if you have that, give it a try. Have Nate review your debates, you know, see where you can grow, see how it's going and go out. You don't have to be doing, you know, there's little Discord. There's other small venues to do it, but just practice being informed, prepared and charitable.
No, that's real good. And, you know, I think the Apostle Paul agrees with you, you know, because when you're saying this, I think of 1 Corinthians 13, where he's like, look, you can be the smartest, paraphrase, you could be the smartest person in the room. You could have all of these abilities and giftings. But if you do not have love, you're nothing. And yeah, that I think you're absolutely correct on that. It does come back to relationship at the end of the day. Like you, this is how I try to get the people around me to think about this. Like, what is the greatest commandment, right? You know, Jesus is approached in his ministry and he's challenged a little bit. What's the greatest commandment? And he gives the Shema, right? Like, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. It's not win debates, you know, it's not be the most effective communicator, you know, it's love. And if it's communicated in love, it'll be received in love.
And they're not mutually exclusive. So like, I'll give you an example, like some people that I've debated, you know, we still have somewhat of an adversarial relationship afterwards, engaging our work and back and forth. And that's fine. That's the spirit of the game when you do apologetics. But there's other people that I have engaged in formal debates or formal dialogues, and I consider them charitable and I would consider them to be friends. I think one example would be I did my debate with Ben Watkins at that's probably one of the best debates that I've ever taken part in. Ben was extremely well prepared. Gave one of the best defenses for atheism I've seen. Now, I think that I responded very well, point for point on everything. But Ben is a really nice guy. Like, we stayed at the hotel together. I drove him to and from the venue. We hung out at the hotel bar afterwards. And we both care a lot about truth. And we can be friends and talk about even non-atheist Christian stuff and have common ground and engage one another because we both care about the truth. And we're not out just to win debates. That's the key. Because he and I... So like at the end of that debate, this is hosted on Cameron Bertuzzi's Capturing Christianity channel. So yeah. We did the debate, does God exist? Very high level debate, like very sophisticated philosophical atheism, went back and forth. At the very end of the debate, we shook hands. I think we hugged actually at the end of the debate. And Ben said to me, we did it. We did it, as in both he and I had accomplished the goal of presenting the best position for each side for people to determine. And so... Yeah. It was mutually enriching in that regard. And I still enjoy talking with Ben. In fact, Ben and I, we did a devil's advocate debate recently where on abortion, where I was pro-choice and Ben was pro-life. Wow. And so we switched. And so, and actually I'll have to talk to you later about that. I have mixed feelings about devil's advocate debates. I don't think I would really do them a lot in the future. I took this particular one on abortion because I felt it was a consistent yet repugnant position. So even if I defend it well, people would be scared off by it. Right. So I didn't mind necessarily defending it. But there we were. And so we were able to come at truth. And he did a very good job defending the pro-life view. So like Ben is an example there. And there's other people that I've engaged and hope to engage in the future. But I think we could have that rapport. So we should have these relationships. And even when it comes to debates, you can have them with people you formally engage if both of you are honest about seeking the truth.
That's right. And this is what I really do hope that everybody watching really listens to your answer there, because I'm trying to communicate this as much as possible in like the interaction section, the comments section, but when you're going to find it as a viewer, when you're going to find a debate to watch, you really should be looking for that filet mignon. You should be looking for the best of the best, the two guys or whatever, ladies, they're operating on all thrusters on both sides. So you get the best views on both sides. And, I really do hope that that comes across. Yeah. So
I also hope we get more women out there to do debates. Men have a natural predisposition to want to like bang our heads together like rams. You know, we're just naturally disposed that way. It's like Right. Only men could invent football, a game where you literally just run your heads into each other.
Yeah.
But I would love like one of my but women can bring very valuable contributions to debate. One of my favorite debaters is a woman named Stephanie Gray Connors. Stephanie. She's done several debates. She does debates primarily on abortion, though she's branching out into other bioethics issues. But Stephanie brings a wonderful charm and charisma. I think a friend of mine said that, you know, she can just, well, he put it in a cruder way than I would have, that she can just destroy opponents by sticking in the knife with just this wonderful angelic smile. And of course, Stephanie does not mean to, she's never been cruel or uncharitable, but she can just demolish a pro-choice position. But she still is very charitable and kind when she's engaging other people. But there aren't as many women involved in debate.
Right.
So I'd like to see, so I'd love to see more. And I would recommend, I'm sure there's women that watch your channel and my channel. If you feel called to it, give it a go. We'd love to see more of that representation out there.
Excellent. Yeah. Agreed. Totally agree. Trent, I thank you so much for your time. I'm really enjoying this, but we're coming to a close and I want to make sure that you let everybody know, like what's upcoming for you? You got any projects or any other debates maybe down the line?
Sure. Well, I've submitted a book. It's a dialogue book with my inner skeptic. So it's where I debate me, the hardest to debate. So I've got a book where I dialogue with my internal sense of doubt, and people I think will like that. Working on other writing right now. I've got a few debates and public dialogues set up for 2022 that I'm going through. One would be a Catholic Protestant debate on Mary. So that's hopefully going to be, that's confirmed for April. February, March, I'm hoping to do two dialogues on the Kalam cosmological argument, one with an atheist and another with a Catholic who disagrees with me about the argument's soundness. So it's a little intramural in that regard. And then after that, maybe this summer, this is still very TBD, but I've been engaging the work of a Protestant scholar, Gavin Ortlund, who's a very charitable, intelligent individual. He has a channel called Truth Unites. I published a response to him on purgatory. And so I'm hoping maybe to do a series of dialogues with him, maybe even something in person. We'll just have to see. But they're a lot of fun. Debates are one of my favorite things. Like, what's funny is I'm kind of scaling back my public speaking schedule. I don't do talks as much because I kind of feel like audio animatronic when I give a talk. I'm like, it's the same old talk.
Right.
But debates, it's just, you never know what you're going to get. So they're a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, like I said, it's quite a treat to watch you do your thing. You're really good at it. And I just want to encourage you, man. Just keep doing what you're doing. And, we'll be watching, you know, and
I appreciate it. Oh, and I'll let viewers know if they want to get more of my materials. I would definitely recommend my podcast, The Council of Trent, C-O-U-N-S-E-L, Council.
Yeah.
And that is available on iTunes, Google Play, and on YouTube as well.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.